This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a piece. Welcome back to the program. In the last hour, we had on the publisher of the Second Amendment Foundation, Dave, what's his name? I'm sorry, I don't have the one. Here we go. Dave Workman was his name. And, you know, I was like, where's this right-wing violence coming from? You know, according to the FBI, we've got twice as many people killed by right-wingers as we do by Muslims or any other group, if you just, you know, if you take 9/11 out of that equation, you know, which I realize some people don't want to do, but, you know, it really was a one-off. If you look at what's going on in America right now, you know, this violence, I mean, here you had the Republican Party inviting, you know, these right-wing Proud Boys, these guys who like to start fistfights and whatnot, to New York for a Republican event where they acted out the 1960 murder of a socialist candidate who was running for Prime Minister of Japan. This guy jumped up on the stage and stabbed him to death on live television in 1960. And they acted this out for the Republicans. And I mean, this is pretty mind-boggling, right? And this whole, and then we've got, you know, this historian Robert Paxton saying that when the Republican Party, when a mainstream political party does outreach to hard right violent people, that is stage two of fascism. We've already passed stage one. And we're into stage two, and that's, you know, pretty spooky stuff too. And then on top of this, we just learned yesterday, I believe it was, that back when the Patriot Prayer guys, Joy Gibson and friends here in Portland were confronting the Antifa protesters down in downtown Portland, that they had a cache of loaded firearms at the top of a parking garage, and we're talking about a sniper and stuff. I mean, you add all this stuff up, and it's like, what the hell is going on in this country? And these guys are explicit in their support of Donald Trump. So anyhow, we had that debate in the last hour, and we've been talking about that. There are a couple other things, though, that I would like to talk about. Ed Young is writing in The Atlantic, in their science section, that in fewer than 130,000 years, we humans have sawed off the most evolutionarily distinct branches from our family tree. Now, if you think of evolution as kind of the opposite of entropy, entropy is where, you know, things just, you know, crumble into disorder and chaos over time. And evolution is where things become more sophisticated and elegant and detailed and complex over time. And the peak of evolution, you could argue, in other words, the most recent products of evolution, principally, are mammals. And what are we doing? We are killing mammals all over the world. I mean, just, you know, wildly. This guy who killed an entire family of baboons is one of the stories that's out there right now. You know, proudly posed with a photo of literally mom, dad, and a half a dozen kids, little tiny, all the way down to a little baby baboon. He shot all of them. And thinks, hey, I'm a great hunter. I mean, this is nuts. And, you know, over 300 species of mammals have gone extinct since the last ice age. Now, you know, some of those went extinct when humans first encountered them. You know, like here in North America, the mammoths, the woolly rhinos, the three-toed sloths. And of the 5,500 remaining mammalian species, fully a quarter of them are right now considered endangered species. We are killing off our, what is it, kingdom, phylum, order, class, genus, what is it, the order? Mammalia? I don't know if it's an order or a phylum or whatever it is, but in any case, we're killing off our nearest relatives in this incredibly rapid rate. And some of us are just insanely enthusiastic about it. Well, you know, if you look at the mammals on Earth right now, what you find is that the vast majority of them, well over 50%, I've heard, you know, I've read in some places that it's actually well over 90%. I can't document that. I can't assert that. But it's certainly well over 50% of the mammals on Earth right now are either us or animals that we are growing to eat. In other words, they're not, you know, the wild things. You could argue we are. But, you know, cows and pigs certainly are not. And sheep and goats and whatnot that are, you know, being grown all around the world for food. And this is you know, another example of the incredible destruction we're wreaking on this planet at the same time that we are altering the atmosphere in ways that are going to be making life, you know, progressively more and more hostile for all of us, essentially. And, you know, this guy, his name is Blake Fisher. He says, I shot a whole family of baboons. This is what he said on his Instagram photo or Twitter photo or whatever it was of him squatting amid loose red dirt and rocks. Blake Fisher posed for the picture, a triumphant grin stretched across his face, arranged in front of him, resembling a macabre family picture, are the bodies of four baboons. The smallest one's head is lolled back, its mouth slightly agape. Crimson blood stains its abdomen. Quiver of arrows is in the foreground. The photo landed Fisher, one of Idaho's... He's, by the way, a fish and game commissioner in Idaho, or he was. And because of this picture, they said, you know, maybe you should resign. You know, which apparently he did. But, you know, what have we come to? What kind of beings are we behaving like? And what does this say about us? What does this say about our future? What does this say about, you know, where we've come from, where we're going, and what we can do on this planet? I mean, this is serious stuff. I would argue that the way that we're treating the other mammals on this planet, and frankly, birds and whatnot, and there was just a report last night, I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, I caught it as I was reading the news about how, wow, thank you, about how in, I believe it was a part of Australia, the insects are vanishing. Well, we've talked on this program a number of times. I mean, I keep getting calls from people, particularly long-haul truckers who listen to us on Sirius XM or, you know, over the air on some of our larger stations, saying, you know, 30 years ago, when I drove through these parts of the country during this time of the year, I had to stop every couple hours and clean my windshield from the bugs. In fact, gas stations used to have, you know, I worked at a gas station as a teenager, and what did I do? I pumped gas, but what did you do when you pumped the gas? You squeegeed the guy's windshield. Why? Because there were dead bugs all over it. There's no more dead bugs. And as a consequence of that, the bugs that eat the bugs and the birds that eat the bugs are dying out. I mean, we're killing the planet. And we need to acknowledge this. And we need to acknowledge that we're doing it in part for some really bad reasons. I mean, you know, eating enormous amounts of meat not only kills the planet, it's killing us. It's not healthy. But on top of that, you've got this mentality, which is literally biblical. But you find it in all the world's major religions, and, you know, because it's basically, you know, that the man, God or the gods, you know, created us to control everything. And so we're just taking charge, dominion over the planet. And that kind of psychology, that you know, top-down, hierarchical, we're the Lord gods of everything, and everything else is either food for us, you know, that then translates into, oh, well, you know, this race is better than that race, or this nation is better than that nation, and therefore, because it's better, it has the right to control them. You know, the same way that we have the right to control other mammals, or go out and shoot families of baboons, because, we're smarter than them. If we don't start to acknowledge that we are part of the web of life on this planet, and I mean fundamentally acknowledge that, like start talking about it in kindergarten, that we are not separate from the web of life. We are a product of the web of life on this planet. And we are dismantling that web. We are dismantling life on this planet. And that's putting us at threat. And then we're using that same mentality to basically dominate other human beings violently, which is, of course, putting us at threat. We need to reboot somehow our religion, our religious perspectives, our morality, and our perspective on this stuff. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Continuing this conversation, Mitch in Burton, Washington. Hey, Mitch, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Well, again, thank you again for taking my call, Tom. Last time I talked about this was with Mark Pocum. Congressman Pocum.
Pocan.
I again want to bring it up. If there isn't anything that's more glaring and in your face about us being fascists is the internment of these children that even defies court orders. I'd like to know what became.
Yeah, absolutely. We're like what the 80 days out from the court order of reunification.
Yeah,
this is crazy.
I mean, I'm looking at the fact that if he is going to go against the law, what's stopping the rest of the people from going against the law? He's setting an example.
Well, you know, I think about the people who, Louise and I, when we lived in Germany, we visited Dachau, and you know, the camps that they built inside Germany were not death camps. Some of them ended up having, you know, cremation ovens, and Dachau did, but it wasn't specifically to kill people. These were labor camps and mm-hmm. and prison camps. And you know, I think about the people who lived near Dachau in the early days, you know, when it was first built, and you know, just thought, oh yeah, well, you know, they're criminals, they're reprobates, they're people who don't fit into society, they're, you know, the communists, the unionists, the gay people, the, you know, and I mean, this is, and Jews, of course, and gypsies, and. You know, how they just kind of sat around and rationalized that. And it seems to me that we're doing the exact same thing with Donald Trump tearing these families apart and putting these children in jails, in prisons, in cages.
And what even concerns me more is, so who's next? Is it the mentally ill? And when they are the ones that are becoming the houseless?
Or is it liberals? I mean, keep in mind, one of the first groups that in fact, in Pastor Niemöller's thing, I think it starts out, first they came for the socialists, you know, or maybe it was the trade unionists, but basically the same thing, you know? I mean, you know, literally, first they came for the political left.
Exactly. And it concerns me, too, that... you know, these are children. These aren't the adults like back in the day of the when the unions were forming, and the anti-children working anti-labor movement.
Yeah,
that was the first indication of that. Yet even the Supreme Court voted it down.
Yeah. Yep.
So we are our own worst enemy, Tom. We can be our own best friend, but we have sometimes. Choose the dark side.
Well, I think this is why we need to be, and I think it's, you know, I'm generally an optimist, and I try to be optimistic about things. It's my nature, actually, to be optimistic about things. But I'm looking at this situation with, the death of life on Earth, basically the destruction mm-hmm. of the web of life, and then mm-hmm. the echoing of that into the destruction of the web of politics, you know, the intolerance that we're seeing on the right for a political point of view that really just says, let's have free education and health care. I mean, you know, that's it. And I think it's all one fabric. I think it's all one, you know, violent, hierarchical, patriarchal, white supremacist sickness, for lack of a better phrase, and human supremacist sickness. Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, excellent point. I missed the kids in the cages in my rant. They really need to be included. We'll be right back. I present your president. In addition to his shortcomings, he has demonstrated his incompetence, hatred of women, and lack of self-control on Twitter again. This is, she's responding to Trump's tweet where he calls Stormy Daniels horse face. And then she says, and perhaps a penchant for bestiality. Game on, Tiny. Yes, game on, Tiny. FBI, the terrorist threat confronting the United States. This is the executive assistant director of the FBI, Dale Watson, testifying that the United States faces significant challenges from domestic terrorists. In fact, between 1980 and 2000, the FBI recorded 335 incidents or suspected incidents of terrorism in this country. Of these, 247 were attributed to domestic terrorists, while 88 were determined to be international in nature. And then, you know, he goes into this long kind of detailed thing about basically the vast majority of these are from what are called right-wing terror groups. The dark and constant rage, Anti-Defamation League, 25 years of right-wing terrorism in the United States. And they start out, you know, in March of 2017, a white supremacist from Maryland, James Harris Jackson, traveled to New York City with the intention of launching a series of violent attacks on black men to discourage white women from having relationships with black men. After several days, Jackson chose his first victim, a 66-year-old black homeless man, Timothy Kaufman. Jackson later allegedly admitted that he had stabbed Kaufman with a small sword he'd brought with him, describing the murder as a practice run. And then, you know, it goes on. For over a century and a half, since burning Kansas of the 1850s and the Ku Klux Klan of the 1860s, right-wing terrorism has been an unwelcome feature of the American landscape. Yet today, many people are barely aware it exists, and most people don't recognize its frequency or scope. To illustrate the threat of right-wing terrorism in the United States, the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism has compiled a list of 150 right-wing terrorist acts, attempted acts, plots, and conspiracies from the last 25 years. This is 93 through 2017. These include terrorist incidents from a wide variety of white supremacists, from neo-Nazis to Klansmen to racist skinheads, as well as incidents connected to anti-government extremists such as militia groups, sovereign citizens, and tax protesters. The list also includes incidents of anti-abortion terror as well as from other smaller right-wing extremist movements. And this, I mean, it's just like, this is what's going on. Here's a new study. A majority of terrorists who have attacked America are not Muslims. Of course, I mean, you know, we've figured this out. You know, they got one off with 9/11, but, you know, right-wing extremists, here's another one, right-wing extremists are a bigger threat to America than ISIS. This is from Newsweek by Kurt Eichenwald, the New York Times reporter. And, you know, he's telling the story, excuse me, inside a storefront, Chinese restaurant in upstate New York, neon light from a multicolored window sign glowed in the face of an extremist plotting mass murder. He had been seeking backing for his attack, and at this small establishment in Scotia was meeting with a man who had agreed to take part in his scheme to build a radiation device, a weapon of mass destruction that would slowly and painfully kill anyone who walked near it. The man who devised the attack told his confederate, "Everything with respiration would be dead by morning. How much sweeter could there be than a big stack of smelly bodies?" Yeah, it turned out the guy was talking to an FBI informant, so he didn't pull this off. But, I mean, this is just, Kurt Eichenwald, the problem is getting worse, although few outside of law enforcement know it. Multiple confidential sources notified the FBI last year that militia members have been conducting surveillance on Muslim schools, community centers, and mosques in 9 states for what one informant described as, quote, operational purposes. Informants also notified federal law enforcement that Mississippi militia extremists discussed kidnapping and beheading a Muslim, then posting the video of the decapitation on the internet. The FBI also learned that right-wing extremists have created bogus law enforcement and diplomatic identifications, not because these radicals want to pretend to be police and ambassadors, but because they believe they hold these positions in a government that they have created within the United States. I mean, the whole sovereign citizen movement is, you know, what they're talking about here. These are very, very bizarre times in which we are living. And I think so much of this is coming out of this fundamental, you know, right-wing view that we have to have strong authority figures, strong father figures in politics. And along with that comes guns.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And along with that, of course, when they don't get their way, comes violence. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I was browsing through the news the other day, and I encountered an article by Pete Tucker on Counterpunch that just blew my mind. And it was about how the headline, partisan pollsters fail black progressive candidates. And I said to Sean, I want to talk to this guy. I want to learn. I want to share this with all of you. Pete Tucker's on the line with us. He is the D.C.-based journalist. And, with Counterpunch, who is the author of this, his website, pete-tucker.com. And you can tweet him at Pete Tucker. Pete, just spelled like it sounds. Pete, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
So, tell us what your, summarize your article, please.
Well, we've seen in this Trump era that polls are not just failing, but they're failing black progressive candidates. And it's not just that they're failing randomly. They're specifically failing by undercounting their support in pretty dramatic ways.
For example,
Ayanna Pressley, a progressive city councilwoman in Boston, she challenged an incumbent congressman in Democratic primary. She was predicted to lose by 13 points. She won by 18, a 31-point swing. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. She also challenged an incumbent congressman. She was predicted to lose by 36 points. She won by 15, a 51-point swing. Stacey Abrams, and then there's three candidates for governor, three black candidates for governor. This country, by the way, has elected two black governors in its history, and we have three Democratic nominees for governor. In Georgia, Stacey Abrams, the last poll had her winning by 20, but she won by over 50. Maybe the most shocking one was Andrew Gillum in Florida. There were 9 polls taken in the lead-up to the Democratic primary. 8 of those polls had Gillum. He's a progressive African-American mayor of Tallahassee. 8 of those polls had him coming in 4th. One of those polls had him coming in tied at 3rd. Florida is the 3rd largest state in the country. Gillum didn't finish 4th, didn't finish 3rd. He won the nomination. Highest poll.
He walked away with it.
He walked away with the highest poll had him at 16%. Most polls at 12%, and he finished at 34%.
Yeah, yeah. So why is this, Pete? I mean, the kind of common sense, simple explanation seems to be that minority communities have historically not been as engaged in the voting process as have white suburban communities, for example. And now they're starting to get more engaged in that process, or they're not just starting. I mean, through the Obama presidency and whatnot, getting far more engaged, but they're not being polled? Or is it that the polling is skewed toward basically white Democrats, white Republicans? I mean, what's going on? Why is this?
Well, I think what happens is that, and I've been learning this as I go along, because it something's going on here.
Yeah, and I don't see any good, clean research on this stuff. This is the kind of stuff that you would think Pew or Harvard would be all over.
It would be helpful. A lot of with polling, there's different types, but it seems to be that most of it is based on a fundamental guess, which is who's going to be a likely voter. And one of the strongest indicators is what happened last election. And you're going to look at the last, non-presidential election. So go back to 2014.
Right.
Well, in 2014, you had historic lows. In over 50 years, it was the lowest turnout in something like World War II. And so if you're going to use that as a base, a pre-Trump election, and then 2016, of course, President Trump is elected. And with all his venom towards women, towards minorities, to pretend that somehow that's a solid base, a pre-Trump election with the post-Trump, is a little bit, I kind of see it a little bit like Rip Van Winkle, in the sense that the pollsters took a 2014 election and then went up into the mountains and went to sleep like Rip Van Winkle and came on down not knowing that a revolution had taken place.
Hmm.
And I think there's a lot more energy than the polls are picking up among young voters, among non-white voters. And so that's my guess as to what's happening. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting, Tom, that these polls aren't just failing. It's not random. They are consistently undercounting the vote, the support for progressive candidates of color. And this turns out to be far more problematic than it's not just a mistake, because there are real consequences
to this. Right. But they're not undercounting or missing progressive candidates who are white. Is that correct?
Well, I have to look more carefully at that. It certainly hasn't been as
gross a mistake, a stark disparity. Yeah, very interesting. Well, Pete, as you continue your research into this, would you keep us up to date?
Yeah, and if I can make one more point, Tom.
Please do so.
This is problematic in and of itself, but it has the danger of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because when you tell voters that your candidate who you support has no shot at winning, then,
as, by the way, the pollsters were speaking about Andrew Gillum in Florida, for example.
Right. And right now in Maryland, Ben Jealous, who the former leader of the NAACP, he was predicted to be neck and neck in the primary. He's the third black gubernatorial candidate. And he won a landslide primary victory that none of the pollsters predicted.
Right.
And now the polls have him way down to the Republican and Larry Hogan in a state, Maryland, that is 2-1 Democratic. And when you put out into the media this powerful message that the candidate has no shot, it's not just voters. You know, voters are busy come election day. People have a lot of things to do. And if you tell people your candidate has no shot, they're more likely to stay home. And also donors.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to back a sure loser.
Yep.
And so this is very dangerous, and this is why the Associated Press, in updating its AP style book earlier this year, it said because polls are so often intoxicating for journalists, the AP is updating its style book with this word of caution to journalists. Poll results that seek to preview the outcome of an election must never be the lead, headline, or single subject of any story.
Hmm.
And yet, time and again, this is what we're seeing.
Well, particularly on television. I mean, television news, I think, is the worst at this, because they're always, breaking news, here's the headline. You know,
yeah,
and it's all horse race stuff. True. They don't even talk about issues. They just talk about horse race and personality.
And this not talking about issues is really significant, because you could poll on any number of things. Hmm. But to keep polling on just how much you like the candidate, but not on the issues. It's not that they don't poll on the issues. It's much more seldom, and it's not as prominently reported. Now, if you had an election here in Maryland on the issues, for example, $15 an hour minimum wage, 71% of Marylanders support that. And you go on down the list, and that's a central plank to Jealous's campaign.
Right.
But that's not what's discussed. It's discussed is how popular Hogan is. And in my reporting, I've looked at the Washington Post, which is liked by many on the left, and because of its aggressive reporting on President Trump, and I'm all for that. But the Post, if you take Trump out of the picture, a nice thought, what exactly is it that the Post is against? It is anti-labor and organization as they come. It's for every war. And it really exists to defeat candidates that are progressive, that are pushing Medicare for all and a $15 an hour minimum wage. And
I think you could say that of virtually all the major media.
I think, yeah, I haven't studied, well, I think you could say
certainly
that.
Certainly network television.
I think you're right. But the Post has been particularly pernicious in how it has given just the most favorable coverage to Hogan, saying he's bipartisan, he's moderate. You know, this is someone who was backed by the Koch brothers, who was with an organization, the Maryland Public Policy Institute, before coming to office that had Koch donor support.
Another little detail that almost never makes it into the press. The Koch brothers are dropping $300 million in this election. Shelley Adelson's, got 10, 20, 30 million. I forget the number. They talk about, it looks like this race is tightening up. I wonder why. And nobody says, well, maybe it's tightening up because they just dropped $10 million into that state, with slash and burn attack ads that in many cases are just plain old flat out lies.
Yeah. And then the poll will say, well, how do you feel about this, that, or the other, rather than reporting on what people actually want as far as where we go into the future. So I think this is dangerous stuff. I think the pollsters are a little arrogant too. I don't think they are really up to seeing what's coming. And I think the media has a much greater responsibility and I'm appreciative of the opportunity, Tom, to talk with you. I think you do a great job of bringing forward some of the issues that need to be discussed, rather than just polling people on who likes who. What are the issues that are at stake here?
Right. Well, I think that's at the essential core of everything. It has to be the issues, and that's where our media does so poorly because it's all reality. The reality TV model is what's been embraced by news. So, they sit around with a couple of pundits talking about something and everybody's opinionating, but they're not talking about the issues. They're talking about, who likes who and who's up and who's down and what do you think? And it's just, it drives me crazy watching talking heads on TV who are not even experts, right, in particular areas. I can understand having an expert on to explain something to somebody. I want Neil deGrasse Tyson to be explaining astrophysics. But anyhow, Pete Tucker, thank you, Pete. Hang on just a second.
To Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Pete's website is Pete-Tucker.com. His article's over at Counterpunch, and you can tweet him at Pete Tucker. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. And welcome back. Robin, watching Free Speech TV in Kingston, Washington. Hey, Robin, what's on your mind today?
Tom, earlier in the show, you had talked about that you weren't sure how to get us out of the little quagmire that we're in right now with the minority ruling the majority. And actually, I feel that I do have a plan to be able to do that. And the entire backdrop of what I'm talking about is what Jimmy Carter said to you in an interview on this program, that we live in an oligarchy. And for that to have happened one way or another, the existing Democratic Party had to be involved. If it were a healthy Democratic Party,
it absolutely was.
That would not have happened.
A lot of the problems that we're facing right now, you can track right back to 1991, when Al Fromm and Bill Clinton put together the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC.
I support that. You are correct, 400,000%. That is exactly where it started. Anyways, the background is that we are where we are, and my frustration with the left, who I sort of call the lofty, lazy left. I love the first and second and third words and don't like the lazy, but when you vote every 4 years, then you can't consider it to be industrial or ambitious. I do believe that we have to somehow change the existing Democratic Party, because as we saw, finally, Michael Moore is the only one who really came out and, for the first time in my view, exposed the Democratic Party and the those who helped it into being part of the oligarchy were exposed.
I think that was the biggest thing on
11/9.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why that movie has not done anywhere near as well as it probably should. When Louise and I went to see it here in Vancouver, Portland, functionally, there were seven people in the theater. And it's because, he comes right out and criticizes President Obama for the Flint crisis and the way Flint was dealt with, and then for using Flint as a shooting gallery with the military. And, he's basically therefore, I think the Democratic establishment has turned its back on Michael Moore.
I agree. And so I agree. So we're talking about the two words you just said there, the Democratic establishment. See, I actually do not think we have one problem with the Republican Party in this country. They are exactly who they are. They just happen to be magnified right now. If you're not a rich white male, who abuses women, you are you know, we don't care for you, period.
Yeah.
That's it. And so, but they're honest, Tom. That's what they are. The problem we have is that the Democratic Party is much less honest, and they are indeed part of the oligarchical, but they're the ones who
I disagree, Robin. I think that the Democratic Party has been, particularly since the Sanders candidacy, the progressives are growing in the Democratic Party. The Progressive Caucus is the largest, I believe, might be second largest caucus. It is within the Democratic Party, it is the largest caucus in Congress. And 100% of the members of the Democratic Caucus refuse to take corporate money or PAC money. It's just like there's some solid stuff happening in the Democratic Party. The Republican Party, on the other hand, is literally lying. They're, you know, even Donald Trump saying, we're going to protect Medicare and Social Security.
I did have more to say.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Robin. The clock caught us up, and I wanted to have something to say, too, in that conversation. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. We're going to check in with Luke Vargas at Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world. Robin, thank you for your call. We'll be right back. So let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world. Today's report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, Alan Ratner's new book on the line with us. You can follow him on Twitter at The Courier as the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News. Luke Vargas joining us from the United Nations in New York. Hey, Luke.
Hi, Tom.
So Pompeo's in Saudi Arabia. I understand he had a 15-minute meeting with the king, who apparently is in full-blown dementia, and a 30-minute meeting with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the prince who is basically running the country. What do we know about this, and is any of this meaningful, and what's the latest shtick that Saudi Arabia is trying to... I understand Turkey came out and said, yep, they found DNA and blood evidence that Mr. Khashoggi, I was saying Khashoggi, I guess it's Khashoggi, was murdered in the embassy or in the consulate. What's the latest on this?
Well, because you mentioned this last, the Turkish sort of line about what occurred last night during this 9-hour period in which there were Turkish crime scene investigators on the scene at the embassy depends on who you ask. And I will say that while there have been some media reports confirming exactly what you just said, sort of more conclusive evidence of blood or other sorts of, remains of Mr. Khashoggi, that Turkish President Recep Erdogan himself has been a lot more muted, saying, look, it's inconclusive. We do have some suspicions that major portions of walls, if not entire rooms, were repainted. And he sort of hinted that that might have been an effort to conceal some sort of toxic substance or otherwise.
Plus, they brought this cleaning crew in, to scrub the place down with bleach before they painted it.
Yeah, I mean, I do think at every turn the Saudis are sending a pretty clear signal that they really don't care about appearances here. If you are going to, and we haven't, these media reports from CNN and NBC, which were, swirling around last night, that the Saudi government had sort of figured out the party line and that they were going to chalk this whole thing up to a botched interrogation, which was evidently supposed to subdue this guy but not kill him and then put him on a plane back to Saudi Arabia. They haven't officially stuck with that narrative. And I wonder who the sources were on that. It is telling, I think, how thoroughly picked through that, kind of line of reasoning was. But I'm not really sure at this point out, 2 weeks after this, if Saudi Arabia can possibly even have a lie here that they can say with a straight face. It's just very difficult to demonstrate that you were concerned about, some rogue actor or something operating within your embassy.
Trump came out and said, if this is true, there's going to be severe consequences. Mohammed bin Salman, or at least his spokespeople, in response to that, said, we will stick a dagger into the heart of the American economy if you try to punish us. Have they backed us down? Has Trump wimped out and rolled over?
Well, I mean, he said pretty clearly that we are not, in the same breath in which he's been saying we are going to vow severe consequences if this guy was killed by the Saudis, he's also made it perfectly clear arms deals are not even on the table. So it's kind of unclear if there's even a middle ground that he has in mind, or he just hopes that at some point some Treasury official could say, okay, here's like two or three kind of pinprick things we could do, and you can go to your, you know, can go on TV right. and say that was.
Speaking of Treasury, by the way, is Steve Mnuchin still going to Saudi Arabia this week or next week?
I don't have him on my list of people I've been tracking who are going to go to Davos in the desert.
As of yesterday, he was still planning to go, but Trump.
I would be surprised if he pulled out. I mean, I just don't think there's any sign from this administration of really any sort of moral reckoning occurring here. And my prediction is that someone on the Saudi side is going to be put forward as a fall guy here. And given the fact that the Saudis have, you know, demonstrated quite a willingness to, you know, basically purge their members of the royal family, members of the business elite in that country, they've got experience dealing with not just sort of mid-level people who they need to, you know, drop through the sky door, whatever that Game of Thrones visual is, but they do this for senior officials too, and which makes me think they will be willing, actually, to blame this on some mid or senior level military intelligence officer and say, look, he was trying to burnish his credentials as a, you know, a hardline guy who was going after enemies of the kingdom, except he actually betrayed the kingdom because he put his own personal ambitions over the interests.
And he may not even be some mid-level diplomat. I mean, they could just drag some guy out of prison and say, okay, you're going to pretend that you're Joe Blow. And they're going to say, this is Joe Blow. He was in the interrogation room. And now we're going to cut his head off and not give him an opportunity to say a word and do a public beheading.
Remarkable, right? I mean, I'm not saying they're not going to do that, but it would be a preposterous seeming to make the fall guy a junior level official when so many media reports suggest this was a major operation that could only have been authorized from senior.
Well, we intercepted intelligence to that effect, didn't we?
Yes. And the Washington Post reporting and others have, you know, suggested that this was, you know, involved a tremendous number of personnel. So we'll see. But I will say, you know, the statement coming out of the State Department today, Pompeo emphasized President Trump's, quote, desire to determine what happened. I don't think we're talking about the same man here. I mean, it's just.
This sounds like the same kind of language we heard after 9/11. Oh, those 15 Saudis, that has nothing to do with it. Hey, quick, get the bin Laden family out of the United States.
In 5 seconds, the joke was that Roosevelt says that, you know, Emperor Hirohito says he denies responsibility as well. You know, it's interesting.
Right. As did Hitler, of course. Luke Vargas with Talk Media News. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back. We're going to be back with Henry Wallace. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.